Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It's amazing that in the course of human history, we went from being unable to navigate the globe to it taking years to get across the earth, then down to months, weeks, days. And now you can sometimes fly to the other side of the world and it takes you 24 hours to go from one side of the world all the way to the other side of the world. And yet, in the world we live in today, there are still places where planes cannot fly. I mean, that's how we're able to go, right? You know, it's not like being in a covered wagon or something like that, or a ship. What has allowed us to really crisscross the globe are airplanes, and in particular, jet airplanes. But even with the advanced technology we have now, there are still places where jet airplanes cannot fly. And that's what I want to talk about today here on Free for All Friday. Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist Trent Horn. On Mondays and Wednesdays, we talk apologetics, theology, how to explain and defend the Catholic faith. But on Friday, we talk about whatever I want to talk about. And today I want to talk about where planes cannot fly. Now, so jet airplanes were introduced back in the 1950s. They were way more reliable than previous prop airplanes that ran on piston engines. They had a much lower engine failure rate, but the engines could still fail. I couldn't imagine, you know, flying in the 40s and 50s. You had the Comet airplane. It had these square windows that put too much pressure on the hull of the aircraft and it would disintegrate. A lot of mistakes were made, and the reason flying is really safe today is because of the lessons learned from many past accidents and tragedies. Something I'm also obsessed with, by the way, I've covered in previous Free for All Fridays, but I love watching Mayday air disaster documentaries. My wife hates it because I always end up watching this stuff, or I'll share it with her, and then we have to go on a plane somewhere, but it's a safe way to fly. But when jet airplanes were introduced back in the 1950s, so you had, in order to cross really long distances, right, transatlantic, trans-Pacific flights, flying to Hawaii or flying to Australia, if you want to make these long distances over terrain where you're not near a friendly landing site, then you would need four engines. So you have, in the earlier days, in order to make these long flights, you would need four engines. Because if one of your engines fails, or two engines fail, if two engines go out on a four-engine plane, you can still be doing all right. You lose two engines on a twin-engine airplane, you've now turned into a glider, and you're not going to be going very much further. So aviation authorities like the International Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO, I think this was back in the 50s or 60s, developed the acronym ETOPS, E-T-O-P-S. That is Extended Range Twin Engine Operations Performance Standards. And so it's the rules of where airplanes with two engines can fly. And originally, it was pretty low. I think it was around like 60 or 90 minutes. I think it might even been like 30 minutes. Okay, that's right. It's 60 minutes. I have it right here. Then you also had some planes. I think it was the DC, McDonnell Douglas had a tri-engine plane. It had an engine actually in the rudder, which to me always seems like an absolutely crazy idea, because the rudder is so important to the airplane. If you lose it, you're basically going to crash, and to have something like an engine within it. And there were accidents that did involve it. I think that was the DC-10. But the very first twin engine rules were 60 minutes. Wherever you flied along your flight path, you always had to be within 1 hour of a diversionary runway. So you couldn't, in a twin engine, for example, fly from Los Angeles to Honolulu, because once you get more than an hour out from the coast, you violated the ETOPS rule, and it would take you longer than an hour to get back to a safe landing place if you're in the middle of the Pacific Ocean or middle of the Atlantic Ocean. So wherever you flew, this was back in like 1964, I think, you had the 60-minute rule. This was then upgraded to 90 minutes by ICAO, this International Civil Aviation Organization, in 1976. And then there were talks about, well, could we ever increase it? In 1980, it says that Dick Taylor, then Boeing's director of engineering, approached the FAA director J. Lynn Helms in 1980 about exemptions to the ETOPS rule. And Helms, who was FAA director, said, "It'll be a cold day in hell before I let twins fly long haul over water routes." But engine technology has increased and gotten better. And so the ETOPS has continued to increase since then. In 1985, it was boosted to 2 hours. I think today the limit now on ETOPS on certain planes is up to 330 minutes. So they're considered to be so reliable that these planes can function with, even if they lose a single engine, they've got the other engine to counteract. They have a lot of redundant safety measures in it. They've been given an ETOPS rating of 330. So that means they can fly anywhere as long as a diversionary airport is at least 5.5 hours away from them. So now that the ETOPS has run closer to 300 minutes or 270 minutes for a lot of planes, that means a plane can fly almost 95% of the Earth's surface because there's always at least some runway, some place for them to divert. However, there are still places where these planes will not be able to fly. There's some places maybe deep in the Pacific Ocean. If you take a certain route, you'd be 6 hours from any kind of landing strip for a large commercial airliner. But also Antarctica. Like if you look at a globe, it's interesting because we think of the Arctic and the Antarctic as complete mirror symmetry. Like they're just mirror images of other ones in the north, the others in the south. But they're really different. Like the go get a globe, not a map, because maps distort our view of the world. Like you look at a meridian projection, like because that's the problem, right? With a globe, like here's an experiment you can do with your kids. Blow up a balloon, draw the Earth on that balloon with a felt tip marker. Then pop the balloon and take all of the pieces and try to arrange them in a map, in a two-dimensional map. The problem is you can't do it. You can't transplant a three-dimensional image on the outside of a sphere onto a two-dimensional surface like a map, a rectangular map, without the image being distorted. So I did a free-for-all Friday on this, I think a long time ago, where you look at different map projections. And they are always going to distort things in particular ways. The closest one is if you take the pieces of the balloon and line them up and leave gaps between them, it looks like a bunch of orange slices. That's one projection that looks really weird. Hardly anyone uses it, but it's probably one of the most accurate projections of the Earth is if you did it that way. If you try to make just a rectangular map, it gets distorted because you look at it and it looks like Antarctica and the Arctic are the same size, and Antarctica looks gigantic when it's not compared to the rest of the world, but it's still big. The Antarctic area, the landmass of Antarctica, is much larger than the Arctic Circle. So if you were to fly, so a lot of planes fly over the North Pole. They take the polar route and will go over the North Pole to go to Asia and North America, for example. And they'll fly over the North Pole, Northern Greenland, the Arctic Circle, even close to the North Pole to be able to do that. And that works because their diversions, if something goes wrong, they're only a few hours away, 1 or 2 hours away sometimes, from friendly air bases. They could fly to Barrow, to Northern Alaska, Svalbard, which I think is in, Sweden. Northern Canada, there's some military bases up there. There are some bases, military bases and other places where these jet airliners could land safely and the passengers could be recouped. However, in one case recently, I think a passenger airliner landed in Canada and they didn't have adequate shelter for everybody. And it was like really, really cold and actually somewhat dangerous. So these planes that fly these Arctic routes have to have diversions. They have to have cold weather suits, appropriate survival gear, things like that. But then if you look at Antarctica, so look at the bottom of your globe, look at Antarctica, way bigger than the Arctic Circle. If you're flying over the North Pole, maybe a few hours to get to one of these friendly bases, friendly airstrips, you fly over the South Pole, it's like 5 hours, 6 hours to get to Ushuaia, the southern tip of South America, trying to get anywhere. And maybe you could get to an Antarctic research station, but it's not, as equipped as just like a regular airstrip in something that's north of the Antarctic Circle. So that's why most planes still to this day do not fly the southern route. So we have the polar route going over the North Pole, but nobody flies a South Pole polar route going over the South Pole. So there are some that skirt it a little bit. I think if you fly from Johannesburg to Perth, you have the Great Circle route. It kind of touches Antarctica a bit. But there are just so many complications. There's also not a lot of demand for routes that would connect like South America to Australia, for example. It might be like why you would fly, or New Zealand to South America. You just don't really have that much demand for those kind of flights. So still to this day, there's hardly anybody running over south over Antarctica. That might change, though. It says there are a few ETOPS compliant aircraft that can do nonstop overflights over Antarctica, like the Airbus A340 or A380. Also, the other problem with flying over Antarctica is that if you get into trouble and land, it's really, really difficult to come and get you and help you. Back in 1979, there was an accident in Antarctica called the Mount Erebus disaster. Air New Zealand was running tourism flights to Antarctica to go and see Antarctica. It's a cool thing, right? They still do that to this day. Air New Zealand doesn't do it anymore because one of their planes crashed into bad weather conditions in the side of Mount Erebus. Everybody died. People went there. It was a huge ordeal to try to go to Antarctica to investigate the site. Most of the debris was just left there and is still on the side of Mount Erebus to this day. But that's why. So given the it's windy, it's cold, the weather's really bad. Half the year it's dark. You can't see anything anyways. Most planes do not do that southern polar route for that reason. And even with the ETOPS, what we have, you're still pretty far away from any help. Very few airplanes could do that complete southern polar route. The next one is Mount Everest. Wouldn't it be cool if you could just fly over Mount Everest? If you look at flight paths around the world, you can see where planes, typical flight paths. There is a section in eastern China that's basically empty. You don't have any flights flying over it. And it happens to be the Himalayan mountain range. Now, why is that? Why don't planes fly over the Himalayas? Now, wouldn't it be cool if you're like, ladies and gentlemen, outside of the cabin on your right side, you could see Mount Everest, the tallest mountain in the world, right down there. Wave hi to everybody who's climbing the mountain there for us. Well, you can't do that because jet airliners have a maximum flying ceiling of what, like 36,000 feet? Most of them fly around 30,000 feet. The Himalayan mountain range, I mean, Mount Everest is, what, 29,000 feet in elevation? So you're already scratching at the surface as a plane. You're flying really low, even though technically you're flying really high. So even the rest of the Himalayan range, a lot of it's around about 20,000 feet. It's a high mountain range. There's hardly any diversionary airports there if you do get into trouble. And if your plane does get into trouble, normally, let's say your plane gets into trouble, right? And you were flying at 30,000 feet. Let's say you lost both engines. Well, this happened actually in Canada. It's called the Gimli glider. There was a miscalculation in the fuel. There was a miscommunication about whether to use standard units like pounds versus metric units like kilograms. And because of that, the plane was not fueled up correctly and it ran out of gas midway through the flight. Both engines failed. And fortunately, the pilot on the plane, or one of the pilots who was on the plane, was a professional glider pilot. He had flown gliders. A glider doesn't have an engine, right? It just soars through the air and slowly falls to the ground. So he was able to divert it to an old drag racing strip and safely land the plane. But one reason he's able to do that is if you're flying at 30,000 feet, you're going to descend. I don't know exactly what it is, 1,000 feet every mile or something. If you lose both engines, you're going to fall. You're going to fly, but you're going to be going down. I don't know. A pilot can correct me on this. What is it, 1,000 feet every mile or something like that? And you can start to calculate. Let's say it were that. Okay, we've lost both engines. We're falling. We're at 30,000 feet. That means we've got 30 miles ahead of us. Or if it's 2 miles for every 1,000 feet, 60 miles. All right, what's our diversionary runways? Where can we get to in 60,000 miles. So the ETOPS rule, by the way, is not based on both engines failing simultaneously. It's based on the fact that modern airplanes have redundancies to be able to keep things flying, and it's really, really rare for both engines to fail. That's why the miracle on the Hudson when Sully landed in the Hudson River, was that 2009, that he lost both engines at such a low altitude, was just something that no one had prepared for because it was thought such a freak accident. What are the odds it's going to happen? So if you lose your engine, you got 30,000 feet, let's say, okay, we got 60 miles, we're okay. But if you're flying at 30,000 feet and the mountains below you are at 20,000 feet, that means you're really only flying, you have 10,000 feet of clearance. That really cuts your ability to fly anywhere, and there's not really anywhere to divert anyways in these high mountain ranges. Hence why it's just dangerous. And also, it'd be very unpleasant. Mountains cause a lot of turbulence for airliners. So your passengers would just hate it because you'd constantly be getting turbulence from the mountains, the air circulating, coming off of them and disrupting the plane's flight path. All right, so those two are basically safety and comfort, why you can't fly over Antarctica and Mount Everest. The next one has nothing to do with safety or comfort. It just has to do with politics. I mean, it was at first about safety. Now it's just about politics. And that would be Disneyland. You cannot fly in your airplane over Disneyland. If you're going there, whether it's in a commercial airliner, in your own personal plane, you can't give people a tour flying over Disneyland. And it would seem like a really fun thing to do, right? You can't even fly a drone over Disneyland. It is or Walt Disney World. It is a no-fly zone. Why is that the case? According to this article, the Anaheim Parks and Walt Disney World received flight restriction status after September 11th terrorist attacks. So later, the 2003 law would prohibit aircraft from flying over stadiums, anything with 30,000 people. So you have the beginning in the early 2000s after September 11th, concern about terrorist attacks. And that, you know, what if someone flies an airplane and purposely crashes it into the happiest place on earth? Not really the happiest place on earth anymore, right? But now we're not as, there's not as much concern about that. But Disney has continually successfully applied for this to be renewed, for this law to stay. No one really feels like challenging it. And Disney for a long time had wanted to keep airplanes from flying over Disneyland. You don't want to spoil the magic, for example, of an airliner flying overhead. Or people would fly in small airplanes with banners saying who knows what kind of message. And that would always, you know, grind the Disney executives' gears. So they want to get rid of that. They want to keep the skies free, open, and nothing to spoil the magic. So this law allows them to do that. Why you cannot fly anything, even a drone, over theme parks like Disneyland or Walt Disney World. Where else can planes not fly? Well, here's another you might think this is obvious. Washington, D.C., around the Pentagon, the White House, Downing Street, so where the British Royal Family Parliament are. So over government buildings, it's a restricted flight area. That's got to be pretty obvious, right? What happens if you were to wander your way in your little airplane into the restricted airspace over the White House? Well, they would evacuate the people in the White House. And if you kept making your way there, you'd probably be shot down with the Avenger Air Defense Missile System. That sounds awesome. America, Avenger Air Defense Missile System, shooting you down. Don't wander into our Don't wander into our airspace is what I meant to say. America. It says here, the launcher, the Avenger Air Defense Missile System. Avenger consists of 8 Stinger missiles and an M350 caliber machine gun designed to protect U.S. Army forces from low-level air attack. Avenger is typically mounted on a Humvee, but the Washington system appears to be mounted on a pedestal on top of buildings around the White House. So I think there was a scare a few years ago, and a few people took pictures that these Avenger missiles come out of the buildings around the White House. And so they pop up, and if like an airplane were flying towards the White House and putting it in danger, because it can take time to scramble a fighter jet. Like on September 11th, they had fighter jets scrambled, but they were still on the tarmac, I think, when the planes hit the towers. It's hard to get a jet fast and up in the air. But these Avenger missiles just pop out of the buildings and can fire 8 Stinger missiles, have like a 2-mile range, I think, and take out an aircraft that is on its way to a government facility. Last two I have on here are landmarks like Machu Picchu and the Parthenon. So the Parthenon, the big white columned structure in Athens, you can fly over it, but you have to be at least 5,000 feet above it. And that's meant to try to protect these ancient sites. If you have planes flying really low, the rumbling and the vibrations over many, many years could damage these older sites. So you can fly over them. Sometimes you can't, but in other cases, if you're going to, it's got to be at least 5,000 feet. You got to be high above them. No low sightseeing tours. And finally, where can planes not fly? At least U.S. airlines and other foreign carriers. You can't fly over Russia. Because there's the middle of a war right now, the Russian-Ukraine war. Because of that, it says that Russia banned airlines from the United States from overflights after the U.S. barred Russia flights in March 22 following its invasion of Ukraine. So back and forth, you're going to ban our planes, we're going to ban your planes. So now a lot of airlines, Finnair, for example, had to change. It had a route from Helsinki to Tokyo, and it ended up extending it. The trip was once 5,000 miles long with 3,000 miles of it going over Russian airspace. They had to fly over the North Pole and extend it to 8,000 miles to fly over the North Pole and fly around Russian airspace. So this one is once again about politics that happens there. And of course, if there are like active war zones, for example, planes will avoid them as well. There was that Malaysian airliner that got shot down when it flew over Russia. This is before the Ukraine crisis. flying over a separatist group. They were fighting and was shot down by a like a Stinger missile or something like that. All right, well, now you know the places that you can't fly. For me, the places I can't fly are basically anywhere I don't have to go because I'm just tired of what airlines have become. They're just such an unpleasant experience, so I actually don't fly that much as it is now. But you never know. All right, thank you guys so much. Hope this was a fun and fascinating Free-for-All Friday and that you have a very blessed weekend.
If you liked today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.